Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I am your host, Todd Embley, and this is part two of our conversation with Dr. Chui Chui Tan, founder of Bayo Global. This episode focuses on practical examples from Dr. Tan's work with global brands, including Spotify and Bumble, and what it really takes to launch successfully in new markets. Dr. Tan unpacks how Spotify adapted its product strategy for dozens of international markets using deep local insight, and how Bumble rethought its approach to dating culture when expanding into APAC. She also shares practical advice on timing, market selection, and the right metrics for measuring success in global rollout. For brand owners, operators, and marketers looking to understand what separates global hits from cultural flops, this episode is packed with wisdom and real-world experience. Enjoy.
Internally, we need to make sure they are ready, because it's as good as you say, oh, and we're ready to go into a new market. But are you ready to accept that you might need to do some adaptations or changes, and you might not feel comfortable doing that? Are you ready and open to learning about a market more so than you actually thought you know about them already? So it's kind of like questioning and assessing with them about their readiness, whether they're actually ready internally to go into a new market. I think that's very important, because otherwise, even though China is a big market and you can grab a big market share, but if your company are not ready, or certain individual or stakeholders in the company is not ready to kind of make a lot of flexibility in terms of how you view adaptations, then I would say don't go into new market first. Sort it out this and kind of look into and understand, have an agreement or alignment, how much you are ready to make the changes.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation. Brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Okay, let's talk a couple of case studies specifically. I wanted to talk about Spotify and then Bumble. Let's start with Spotify, because you worked with them to gain user insights across dozens of markets. What were some of the challenges that Spotify faced adapting to different local markets? And how did your research insights help inform Spotify's product or growth strategy internationally?
Challenges in terms of launching in the new market or growing in the market. I think it's very competitive, right? Even though they actually have captured very big market size, market share globally, but it's still very competitive market. And some markets, they are competing with free YouTube, for example, because it is free, then why we need to do it? So converting those users, that is very challenging sometimes, but I think our challenge was to understand why people in different countries didn't want to pay. Is that because economy? Because sometimes we found all these different countries, very basic assumption is because they can't afford, but then the price have been reflecting on the country's levels, on the country level. So it shouldn't be too much of the barrier. Or is that because the mentality of I can get it for free, it's like water, I can get it for free, then why do I have to pay? So those kind of mentality. Or is that because they don't see the value of it? Like for example, in a lot of countries and in Indonesia or in India especially, people are more, Africa as well, people are thinking more family oriented. So for example, paying for music feels a bit selfish because I'm the one going to use it. But paying for Netflix is different because my whole family is going to watch it. So it's the benefits of whole family is getting the benefits. So it's more justified. So that could be a reason for that. Or is that because they don't they don't see the value, so they need something else to kind of push them to the other side of the fence. Hence, we're looking in the insight in terms of white space, like what are the things which actually make that countries more encouraged and more enticing to that countries to kind of get into wanted to pay, subscribe and so on. So I think I can say this because they already launched. So one of the things like white space for Indonesia, for example, it was they launched something for fandom, K-pop fandom, because it's huge. It's huge in a lot of countries, but in Indonesia, we found that actually is very big and important. So they have a few fandom ideas, fandom propositions that actually just specific for that market. They have listening party. They have things that actually the artists can talk to them when they launch a new album or so on. I think they expanded to other countries, so I'll call listening party. So it's kind of like using those insights. So I was working with them a lot to identify those white spaces. So the key things we always work together in understanding the cultural nuances is what is actually the barrier and what will actually encourage people to want to use Spotify and then to convert them into premium. So it could be in the very early stage. I worked with them for 7 years. So early stage is more about payment method. You want to make sure the payment method is right. But as any companies, if you want to get into the payment collaborations or partnership, you take times and investment and so on, right? So you want to make sure it's the right decision so you can make a business case to kind of change that payment methods. So it's, and we look into the payment methods, how important it is. Is that going to convert? That is the earlier on. And is that the content that we are kind of pushing? Is that how it's going to help people to kind of get into that? So at the very beginning of early stage of Spotify, it's more about the more basic things. These days, it's more about the white spaces, what other the other things actually will get to people. That's why all the research, Spotify is very, very cultural and research driven in terms of they're making decisions. So that's why they actually have podcasts, right? Now they are not just music services platform, they are audio services platform, streaming platform. And so they have audiobooks now in some markets as well. And then they have this educational content as well in the UK. I don't think it's in America yet. I might be wrong, but if you are premium users, you actually can get, you know, masterclass kind of content. Yeah. So it's similar to that. They were partnering up with companies like BBC, Maestro and so on. So you can actually access those educational content already as a market, as a products and premium users as well. So all these insights are really important to help Spotify to make any decisions. So very earlier on, for example, we did some research on users, like, for example, Philippines. The Philippines have this sachet mentality that they buy things in a small package. So if you go to the Philippines, they have these shops called Sari Sari Store. So there are like moms and pops store that in the corner of the shop, you can get it everywhere. If you look at them, if you Google search on the image, you can see there are a lot of sachets. You have conditioner in sachets, you have shampoo in sachets, you have instant coffee on sachets. And so you can buy garlic in cloves, you can buy cigarette on sticks, you can buy oil in cups. So it's all small elements. But that is because of their history, right? They're pre-colonial, where they have to barter with Chinese and traders, and they have to kind of have small elements and to exchange. And then you have the post-colonial, which is the economy become hard. So cash flow is hard. So they need to buy things in small elements. So they have all this still here, still there. And even wealthy people are still buying a lot of sachets rather than buy a big bulk, because it's a habit that they're familiar with, not just because they can't afford that anymore. So with that, it's very easy to look at that and say, oh, that's interesting. If you go to Philippines, that people buy things in the small sachets. But if you kind of step back and look into that, then you say, what does that mean to my business? So for example, for Spotify, what does that mean? That means actually people have this sachet mentality. They have this called tingy culture that I only want to pay what I I'm going to use. Paying for monthly is kind of quite a big thing, right? Like I'm paying this, but I'm not going to listen in next 3 days. I'm losing money. I'm not making use of the post value out of that. So with that, and then we have there are further research and so on. Spotify actually launched a mini plan that is only for daily and weekly, but actually they scrub the daily, so you can buy it on weekly. And even though that insight is from the Philippines, but also we start to see in other markets as well, like Malaysia and Indonesia and Thailand and so on. So they also apply the same propositions in those markets as from the insight. So that is kind of like really the examples of things that you can use insight to inform your propositions and help you to de-risk the decisions you were going to make. Rather than say, we're going to do this, look into it. And then you might actually think it's not needed. That payment method is not important. You don't have to go into that. Instead, focus on the other thing as well.
So now I want to talk about dating, because you were a consultant with Bumble as they expanded into new countries as well. And so this to me would be very unique. Obviously, there would be a lot of culturalization understanding that would need to be had. Tell us what it was like working with Bumble and trying to help a dating app enter markets in APAC or elsewhere.
So I worked with Bumble for their Japan market. So they already in Japan and they wanted to kind of understand a bit more so that they can make a bit better decisions on not just on the product side, but also campaigns and positioning and so on. So what we did is actually we did some competitor analysis as well, right? To look into, because you will be surprised how many companies there are in Japan for dating websites or dating apps. There are a lot of local ones and then international one. I think while we were doing the research was Bumble and Tinder. Most of them, but there's so many local ones. And then we start to plot them in terms of where they are in the market, right? You have some of them is very serious. I go in here because I want to get married. So you better be serious if you sign up for this one. And then you have one is like, yeah, it's more about how connected we are in terms of hobbies or in terms of who we are and so on. So those are more spiritually connected, like personality. So you fit it into this kind of category and so on. So there are a lot of them. And it was interesting to see where Bumble can actually sit in the market, right? Like, they are not going to be casual ones. That a lot of perceptions about Tinder in that market is more casual dating. They go to that platform. But where does Bumble want to sit within that market? And is that aligned with their own core brand as well, core value? Because that is very important for businesses not to try to adapt into the local market too much that they lost themselves. But you also don't want brand who is so rigid that don't want to change anything in local market. So you need to find a fine line. So where's the fine line for Bumble in Japan? And so we also look into the cultural element in terms of how people view dating online. As things have moved on, being not as traditional that you know you have to meet in certain ways, you have to meet in person and someone have to introduce it to you and so that you can go into that as well. And as you know, Bumble has been their main propositions as women make the first move, right? So it's online dating. So for those who actually didn't know, because I always assume like everyone knows. And then I have people who say, why is that? Because they are married for 25 years. They haven't used all the dating website and so on. So Bumble is kind of like a bit like Tinder swiping on match based on the photos and a bit of information. And then you say, if I swipe right and the other person swipe right, then we will match. And then on any other platforms that either parties can actually start messaging each other. If you don't reply within 24 hours, then the match will be gone, right? So you have to skip talking. But Bumble started off with woman makes the first move. So woman, if you match, women have to send the first message within 24 hours. And then only after that, men will reply within 24 hours for everything to work. So they wanted to know at that point, they're also looking into their overall value propositions around the world as well globally, because then they have this LGBT come in and, you know, people were talking about feminism and everything else. So they were thinking about, okay, what does that mean in Japan? Because is that a traditional view of value in terms of women shouldn't mix anymore? Women should be quieter and let men make the big decisions and so on. But it was interesting because there, we went in with so many assumptions based on what we think the culture is or the culture has been. But things have moved on a lot. Actually, users are fine with that. Men is actually is good. They start talking, then I don't have to think about what to write. But then women say, I'm fine with doing that, but it's just I don't know what to talk about or writing about. So that part is quite consistent with other countries because it's the same thing. So it's good to know there's not a perception that women can't make the first move and that will stop people from using as well. So that was a good insight for them to not have to worry too much about that cultural instance. But then we also look at the pricing and positioning in terms of subscriptions and payment. There are a lot of, if you look at them as a whole, a lot of them, especially local ones, women actually don't have to pay first in a lot of features. And then men have to pay. And then if women wants to use more features, then they only start paying. But men has to pay from the very beginning. And you can see that very consistent in the single cafes that they have, where it's the physical shops or physical cafes that you go in. Women actually can have all the drinks they wanted. And if you turn up, and then men will pay, and then you cannot chat. If you cannot get along or connected, then you become friends and so on. So there's this kind of perceptions. So if you don't do that, you go in and you say, women all have to pay, then there's a mismatch in terms of expectations on where you are with compared to other companies or your competitors as well. And then we look at the products as well. It's like there's assumptions where it's very important of certain features like zodiac, blood type, and so on. Because if you look into the filtering of all this, they have 30 or 40, 50 filters in a lot of the competitors' websites, especially local ones. So it's very easy for Bumble to say, oh, we need them. We need to do it now and we will need to build them. But actually, it's interesting that when we talk to the users, a lot of them, they don't care. They don't use it. Some of them, they do, like knowing Saturday, Sunday, is your off days are Saturday, Sunday. If your off day is Monday and Tuesday, then we might not match. Those are important. Smoking or non-smoking, for example, is very important because this smoking is a big thing in Japan, but now a lot of people start not to smoke. So there are certain things that are important, but blood type and all those, although it's important when they talk, but it's not important for them to swipe. Actually, they don't have to be urgently build those features. They can save that effort and money and investment into something else. So these are just a few examples. Then we look into the campaigns and how did they do campaigns, how Japanese actually view marketing and promotions. Is that on the TV? Is dating things? Actually, there's a regulations that recently changed as well. Before that, dating websites are actually not allowed to be on the TV. And then there's a regulations, so then because there's a trust issues and there are a lot of things you have to go through as well. You need a certificate on your website to say you are these are actually certified. Then people know you are actually a genuine dating companies. So there are a lot of all these regulations and things like that you need to kind of look into. Is you can still appear in Japan. For example, Bumble can still have in Japan, but having that certifications stamp on your website, it means a lot for trust issues. So those are just some examples that I can share because it's commonly known.
So if I came to you or a brand comes to you right now, have a very local presence in a particular market, and they come to you and say, we think we're ready to go global. Help us choose which country to go to. How do you react to that? I'm assuming that you don't just accept their position. They're ready to go global. I'm assuming you probably have your own opinion on whether they're ready to go global. And I'm wondering what factors might change or affect or impact your opinion of their readiness to go global. But then if you do decide that they are, how do you help them choose where?
I think the first one is like internally, we need to make sure they are ready, because it's as good as you say, oh, and we're ready to go into a new market. But are you? Are you ready to accept that you might need to do some adaptations or changes, and you might not feel comfortable doing that? Are you ready and as open to learning about a market more so than you actually thought you are, you know about them already? So it's kind of like questioning and assessing with them about their readiness, whether they're actually ready internally to go into a new market. I think that's very important, because otherwise, even though China is a big market and there's a big market, you can grab a big market share in that market. But if your company is not ready, or certain individual or stakeholders in the company is not ready to kind of make a lot of flexibility in terms of how you view adaptations, then I would say don't go into new market first. Sort it out this and kind of look into and understand, have an agreement or alignment, how much you are ready to make the changes in that instance as well. So that is the first thing that I will look into. Look internally first before you start to look externally to help them to assess that. And then a lot of times people think about indications of they're ready to extend internal expansions, international expansion. They will look into like reaching that. It's because their market, their home market is already saturated. They think they actually done everything they have it. Or they actually have a strong financial that they think they actually can go further because they have the enough investment and so on. Or they have competitive pressure where they kind of feel like they need to go into it because otherwise they will lose. So I'm very important to let the company know, don't actually make decisions just based on these things, right? Because they might be the wrong decisions to do that. So you ask about, and then look into the timing as well. Like, is that the right time to go into that market? So that is part of the things that exercise I talk about, like effort and opportunity that I talk about, right? I have this exercise where you plot, let's say we look into it and we actually shortlisted four markets. China is one of them, Indonesia because of population, India is one of them, and then we have one smaller markets, Singapore, for example. And then we will say, okay, out of these four, let's do an exercise to see what are the opportunity of these markets. One of them is the market size. It's big populations, the TAM, the SAM, and the SOM is actually quite high. The addressable market is high, so we can actually capture them with our product and so on. So there's a big opportunity there. What are the opportunity? Okay, it's actually quite easy because our brand is actually associated very well in that market because of the value we bring in. It's very aligned with their value and so on. So we talk about the opportunity and plot them in the axis, right? So you have y-axis and x-axis. One is effort, one is opportunity. Then you plot them into that. Effort-wise, it could be like we talk about, is the cultural distances versus business model distance. So do the problems you're solving for the product market fit in the home country, is that the same as is that manifested in the same way as if they are in China or in those four markets that you share? Or do you have to do a lot more educational elements to change people's behavior, which will take a long time? Changing behavior is quite hard. Or changing people's perceptions about doing certain things. Like, for example, in China, IKEA, Home Depot failed for a long time before that because they went for DIY. China wasn't ready to do any DIY work in terms of furniture because they got someone to do it. But IKEA went in a slightly different things where they actually have design elements within that, right? You have showrooms and everything. So Home Depot went in with a slightly different, solving different solutions. Home Depot went in trying to solve a different problems when it doesn't align with the culture, local culture. And then you have to ask about the is your brand purpose actually aligned with the cultural value in that market, right? So for example, if it is a sustainable product that you're focusing on, then you probably want to prioritize market actually very much into that mentality, so that you don't actually realize you need to be sustainable. You need to kind of look after the world, the environment and so on. So you can choose the market that is actually slightly different. So there are all these things. And then the other thing is also about timing, right? Where is the window opportunity for you to get into that market specifically? Is that the right time? Or is that too late in the game that it will need to take, because it's so saturated in that market, you know, it will need to take you a long time to get into, to be seen, to stand out. So you might want to look into the smaller market to start off. Because sometimes it's better to go smaller markets first before you go all in a market that is so big and not familiar with. So for example, I'm talking about market, I'm not talking about countries as such, because for example, you can start off with Taiwan first or Hong Kong first, and before you go into the mainland China and kind of thing. So you can start off with even a smaller region or smaller market size, so that you can learn from it and don't make a big mistake. And then otherwise, if you go straight to a big market, for example, in China, and you got it really wrong, it's really hard to get back. Sometimes because your reputation is already hurt, or it's really hard to gain that trust back or to recover. So sometimes it's good to test with smaller market with a similar value or similar culture or similar ecosystem set up, then try out, learn it from there, and then go into the bigger market. So all this is about choosing the right market and thinking about whether it's finding the right balance between effort and opportunity, and also timing as well.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the common mistakes, okay? And I don't want to forget about success, but let's do success after this. Let's start with some common mistakes or pitfalls that you've seen working with companies, some of maybe a misstep or misthinking or bringing too many assumptions or some things like this. What are some of the, when it doesn't go well, why did it not go well? What are some of the common mistakes companies might be making when they don't do international expansion correctly?
So I have a three levels of culturalization model. So the first level, it was about establishing respect. So in that instance, if you go into the market, that is the most basic thing you have to do. So you don't want to do anything that is offensive, showing disrespect, whether well, most of the cases you did it accidentally or not deliberately, or you make joke political issues, right? Like challenges. So for example, you don't want to present some information that you market your products in a wrong way that offends a religions or a beliefs that society is actually believing in. So I give an example. It's not about launching, but it's actually big companies that make those mistakes. So for example, it could be the marketing. Dolce and Gabbana actually make a mistake about a few years ago about an ad that they have a Chinese woman trying to eat pizza and spaghetti with chopstick awkwardly. And they make it a big thing. Actually, it was quite offensive. It's not very respectful on that. So they have to actually, both the founders have to come out and say sorry and actually apologize on that. Or you can make a mistake in terms of you creating products that is actually not relevant to the market. For example, e-commerce website actually have masala beef, for example, but say India taste, but it's actually Indians doesn't really eat beef because they see that as a holy animals and so on. So there are things that you actually don't want to make mistakes. The other thing as well is it can be a smaller things like you design a website, right? You have icons. So this actually happened with a hotel company I work with. They went into China. They were designing the icon to represent dining in Asia. So they have one of the icon was a bowl with a chopstick, and which is fine, but the chopstick was stick straight up. As you know,
Yes.
You shaking your head right away. So yeah, in a lot of culture like Chinese, China or Japan, it's the same thing because that actually feels, that actually is representing you feeding the food to your ancestor who already passed away, or so you don't do that. So, but even small things like that, right? A small thing you could actually offend a certain culture or religion and something. And then geopolitical as well, like you, I think a lot of company, I can list out 10 of them, is, for example, Marriott did that as well, like in their, they didn't do it internally, but they actually have an agency to do a survey. And in the survey, they have a drop down which country you are, and then which country you are. And then one of the countries have Tibet and Taiwan and Hong Kong. And China actually closed down Marriott Hotel website in China for a whole week. That lost them a lot of money because China is their biggest market outside the US. But there's so many companies does this kind of mistake. McDonald's have an ad that have 2 seconds of student cards that show countries, Taiwan, and they have backlash and they have to take it down and so on. So there are a lot of small things like that, but it's actually a respect because there's geopolitical issues that you have to respect and things like that. So my first label was that don't make that mistake, because if you move into a new neighborhood, you don't want to do something that is actually offend your neighbor right away. So you are not going to be acceptable in that neighborhood, right? It's the same thing. Show your respect, show you understand them and trying to like blend in so that you can show their respect. And then the second level is more about experience, that basic experience. So for example, we talk about the currency, language, name formatting, right? For example, I'm Chui Chui Tan in the UK, but I'm Tan Chui Chui in Asia, because the first name and last name came in. And even though that is very small things, imagine you are designing a website or capturing information about your users so that you know how to address them. And people don't read, right? They just remember, I always put my first name first or last name first, and then they just type in, and then you end up capture the wrong information, you address them wrongly and so on. And then you have all these small things like social network that we talk about, payment method we talk about, numbering, and then like discount as well, right? Like in China, like we say 25%, we'll say 25 and then percent. But in China, it's 75, which is like discounted. So it's actually show in a different way, right? So you need to know how actually people, this is a basic experience. They are not even going to expect something else. Like this is just basic what they are familiar with.
Well, if you've done work in China, they have addressed you as Mrs. Nancy or Mr. Mark or Mr. Kevin, or you know, they're, and you find it odd that they're addressing you as, you know, it's the formatting of the naming, where again, like you said, over there, your family name, which would be Tan, would come first. I would be Embley Todd, not Todd Embley. So because my name Todd is first, they assume maybe they Todd. Just, and they're just, the habit is to,
yeah,
that's, you know, like Ms. Tan or Mr. Todd, that, you know, that's just, they think that that, you know, might be your family name, but they probably haven't actually consciously thought that. That is just the rote. That is the inertia of the human behavior and the habit. They just say Mr. and whatever the first word is.
Yeah. It's what we're familiar with, right? Like, and that's why it's assumptions that people are making in terms of what they think they are familiar with in that environment. And that is what they view how things work in other countries as well. I think it's, as a company, we need to be aware of that. As a user, we just they will just take it in as what it is because it's actually expectations. If you are selling to me, you need to respect me and you need to give what I want rather than I have to adapt to you and your business and so on, which is fair enough, right? And I always say this, I always, when I give a talk, I always end it with this. So it's like a good local adaptation is the one seamless where your users didn't even know you're actually doing these adaptations to them because it's so seamless. It's just what they are familiar with. It's what they like. They can connect. They can resonate with that. But if you get it wrong, they will realize that and they will actually hate it or not using your products or not coming back and so on. Like even dates formatting, right? Not even talking Asia, like in the UK and in the US is already a big thing, right? We in the UK, you have dates, month and year. And in the US, it's month, date and year. So if you book a hotels or train tickets or concert tickets, you got it wrong and you will be annoyed, right? So if the kind of local adaptations is seamless, it's good, it's what is expected, and you will get that experience and they will like it. But if it is small things that's not going well, they will realize it. So
it's friction.
Yeah, it's friction.
It's yeah. And it's so that it's, is it's unpleasant.
Yeah, it's something not that barrier. Yeah,
yeah. Exactly. I want to intuitively know where to go to the home screen. I want to know intuitively in an app, where are my settings? How do I log out? You know, that you intuitively being able to navigate, you know, that UI of something. If it's not intuitive, it becomes frustrating. I close the app, I move on, I go do something else. And I probably don't go back very often. And yeah. It can be that simple. That's why website loading times can even be important because people's attention span is so short nowadays. I'm not going to wait. If it's not important, I'm not going to wait. So give it to me now or see you later.
Yeah. And also this is relevant to culture as well. Some culture is more patient than the others because of what
they're more used to it.
Yeah,
they've had to wait.
Like in South Korea for years, their internet speed was so fast. It's like... It's for the games, right? Because they were so into that earlier on as well. So in China as well. So it's expectations on that. But I want to kind of finish off with my bottle. I have the first respect. And then secondly is a basic experience. And then the last one was the layer of experience enhancement. So that is where you already done the basic. You already have the respect, but you can do something that tip them over to feel, oh, wow, this is amazing. This is really resonate to me. And this is the more complicated layer that you most of the time you do need to dig deeper into cultural elements to understand more about, you know, the behavior, the story behind so that you can be more innovative in that sense to say, ah, they like this and like that. So I can equivalent that to certain things. So you can provide them with another layers of examples of things.
Okay. Now, speaking of examples, we're close to the end. So I just wanted to ask on success and measuring success. Just real quick, what does success look like? And what is your advice for being successful based on your experience? What have you seen other brands do that has propagated success in expansion? And then how do you know that they've been successful? How do you measure success?
I think if you want to measure, there are two layers. One is the basic success measurement where any company will measure, right? Like, oh, what is the growth rate? What is the retention rate? What is that? But that is all good in terms of seeing how successful you are in that market. But if you want to measure cultural relevance, relevant measurement or metrics, then you need to kind of go into deeper into that. So it's multi-layered and I see that as quant and qual metrics, so quantitative and qualitative metrics as well. So quantitative metrics could be how you see people using your product. So I was working a messaging app company and we launch it and we'll grow it in a certain markets in Asia and in Southeast Asia. And what happened is we saw actually the MAU or the DAU, so the daily active users and monthly active users is actually really high. And that is all good and really good. But when we dig deeper into it and we realize actually most people are actually using the basic features, and they're not using the culturally important group communications features. So like the what we expected, right? Because in Southeast Asia, or Asia in general, people are collective. People are more collectivist. They are more care about the group interactions and group bonding and so on. So we should expect that actually they will be using a lot of those kind of culturally grouped communications features and so on, and they won't. So it wasn't really aligned with the cultural elements that we expected. So with that, sometimes you need to dig deeper into what are you measuring, not just the normal like monthly active users, how long people stay in your app, on your app and so on, but you actually need to look into that a bit more. So and then you can do, like, for example, the other measurement is that when, let's say, you do certain local adaptations that you know is definitely needed, for example, payment. I use payment because it's everyone is easily understandable. So let's say in China, you know, Alipay is definitely a big payment method. Or in the Philippines, you have GCash and so on. So you actually take time and effort to invest in that. And you created that, have partnership and created that. And you should assume there's a high level of acquiring users or high level of increase of people buying things or so on, but you actually don't see that. So that means actually the cultural elements wasn't in that particular things. You might need to look into the other cultural measurement as well, in terms of what it is, because sometimes it's not just about the UX or the experience, but the frictions might be a lot more cultural related in that instance. In terms of quality, you might want to see how this is a good example. So you might want to see how people using your product. So you might intend people to use it for a certain things, but then you start to see they adopt it to use it for other things. So what would be a good example? Let's say WhatsApp, right? WhatsApp, another messaging software. WhatsApp, you actually created that so that people can use that for communications with friends, with personal friends, or with more personal use, right? But how does it evolve? It evolved into a professional use now in many countries. In Malaysia, like all the hospital, I was actually communicating with my doctor on WhatsApp about certain things that I forgot to ask, or kind of bank as well. You can have WhatsApp to do that. A lot of businesses on that. It's also in other countries, for example, in Thailand and so on. So this is a good measurement when the locals actually using your products in a way that you are not expecting, but actually in a different way that they adapt into their environment. That means that actually you created a need for them, even though that you didn't know the need was relevant to the different cultural elements. But they actually show you the way that you are doing in the right way to do that. So these are just a few examples of how you can measure in a slightly different way, whether you're actually adapting correctly or adapting, finding the bond with your local users.
So your parting advice, what, with all your experience, what are the key pieces of advice that you want brands, brand decision makers, brand owners that are listening to this, what are your key pieces of advice that you would want to pass along to them as far as a guiding principle or a mindset they should have when they're thinking about global expansion?
Probably give three quickly. So one is cultivate a genuine cultural curiosity environment within your company. I think that's
very... I love that. That's good.
That is important because otherwise there's no point you trying to learn something, but you're not curious and all. We just like, yeah, we learned that. Sure.
It's so grounding. Like that is so embedded, and that's going to pay dividends. Also like in the long term, sustainable dividends, but also I think there's going to be unique findings because of that culture that you create. Anyway, I interrupted you and I'm sorry. I really
No, it's good. It's good to hear your reaction on that because because I thought it's very important. That's the point that we went back earlier to see whether they are actually ready or not. This is important to assess how ready they are in terms of, you know, being curious, being open to make changes. So it's very important to have organizational curiosity, not just mentality, but also capacity as well and capability to want to kind of be open and investigate further and so on. Because you could have get a lot of cultural insights or intelligence, but you're not going to be curious. You're not going to dig deeper into what does that mean and so on. It's not going to be any use on that. And the other thing is like recognize that timing matters, but you don't have to wait until you know, you felt like you know everything before you launch. So some company, well, there are two types of companies. One is like, we didn't know anything, but we just launched, we translate languages, boom. And then we do it. And then we're trying to improve it after that. It might be too late. Like as we say, it should start from the very beginning. But we have companies that actually will worry so much that they're trying to, oh, can we know this? Can we know that? Can we put together, have all the views before we actually go into market? Don't do that. So you need to find the right balance between the two where you actually find line. So learn enough for you to kind of organization to say, actually, we're ready to do that. But don't stop there. I think this is the third advice that I'm giving. Don't stop there because like we talk about culturalizations is a continuous journey. So don't just do it as in a market entry expense, right? It's not just that. When you get into the market, it's not like you're done. You need to continue doing that and you need to have a continuity and flexibility to continue understand it, especially in market like China, it's huge, right? It's not like you settle one thing and you capture enough users and that is it. You have to kind of, oh, where is the other unserved users or untapped audiences that you haven't touched on within the countries? How do we actually talk to them and communicate with them so that we can capture them even more into the market as well? So I think these are the three things that I would say is important. Of course, there are a lot more, but let's leave that for this three.
There certainly are. There certainly are.
Yeah.
Dr. Qixi Tan, founder and director of Bayo Global, thank you very, very much for all your time, both on this podcast and part one. We really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. If you want to catch us on the video version, go to the WPIC YouTube channel. Catch us there. Obviously, if you're watching the video and you want to go to the audio only, we're available on all the favorite podcast platforms out there, including Spotify, which Dr. Tan has worked with before. If you have any feedback, if you have any guest advocates that you want to put forth and let us know would be a great guest, somebody you'd want to hear from yourself, please don't hesitate. Reach out, let us know how we're doing. It's at podcast@wpic.co. That's the email address you can send it to. Please don't forget to like and subscribe. It really helps. I know that we don't have to in the world of streaming. You don't need the weight of those downloads on your phone. But if you like, subscribe, give us a 5-star review. It helps those algorithm monsters and helps more people find out about this program. So on behalf of me, on behalf of the team at The Negotiation, and on behalf of Dr. Tan, thank you very much for listening and or watching. We will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.